You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore, with again the poet of plenty, Alan Wolowitz of Long Island, who's well published in several works, the recent In the Muddle of the Night. There's one that you mentioned here called Floored. Was that a collection of yours?
No, that's not a collection of mine. That was it's an anthology of poems that happens to be based on a line of my poetry. And for some reason, people responded to that line of poetry. And I'll read later the poem that contains that line, and you can judge for yourself.
I do notice, of course, we're going to hear another from The Story of the Milkman and one from Exactly Like Love. That is a collection, right?
That is a collection. That's yes. A chapbook.
All right, so there are several books of Alan's that a person can look for, and I'll mention those again at another time, but we're going to start out. Alan, read Before.
Yes, I'll read Before, and I won't give a long introduction, but since I know your audience, David, is mainly in the Northwest, I'll just mention that the Verrazano Bridge, which this poem's references, is the bridge that connects Brooklyn to Staten Island in my part of the world. So listeners might need to know that, but they might not. Before, I'm nine and behind the wheel of our green and white 55 olds. I start to check the mirrors, but my father tells me not to worry what's coming from behind, though I know he always does. The belt curves round to the right near the Bay Parkway exit, and I see houses and parks and empty lots in the distance and people walking on Shore Road dressed for the weather. What's missing is the Verrazano up ahead, that behemoth that looms over everything on land and on the sea, and whose towers you can hardly ever see in the morning fog. It's 1958. Building it had not yet begun. Careful, Aloysius, he says to me, though he knows I'm scared and more apt to wander from my lane unwittingly than be foolhardy or reckless. I am my father's son. This is a game I call Before. And as the bridge appears in the distance today, as it always does, maybe I can see it new, an approximation of the wonder that I've lost, that the years of easy living have worn away. Imagine seeing it now as if for the first and being stunned by its grace, its size, its utterness, the way it swallows up the boats, the streets, the houses. Father showing how to sail a boat, to skim a stone, kids on bikes, their fathers holding on and huffing from behind. Fathers teaching their young how to drive and secretly pressing an imaginary brake to slow the car and the press of time. Even a father's memory of all that came before. And he never got a chance to tell.
He had many other stories to tell, and I'm sure that they were full of his own imagination of the welter of life on the streets, different from what you imagine here, but you really bring to life very much community, society out and about doing all kinds of activities. We wish we could see that sort of welter of activity. That's why it's so stunning. That's, I think, why it's so wonderful to imagine again, seeing it for the first time. Because do we see that kind of action in society as much today? Probably not.
Yes,
all at once, anyway.
We get inured to what is and to what we're used to. And the game of trying to close my eyes, well, not too much while I'm driving, the game of closing my eyes and trying to think about what the scenes we're so used to look like 40, 50 years ago, it helps to build the wonder in us, I think.
Yes. We weren't perhaps too concerned about the gadgets we had in our pocket pinging away. We were outward interested.
Yes. As you were saying that, I reached into the gadget in my pocket and made sure it was on silent.
All that's known. Let's go with that one.
Yes, that's a poem about my mother. And, you know, towards the end of her life, I tried to conjure to come to terms with who she was. And that's what this poem is. All that's known. My mother fallen, hip cracked, now replaced, sits slumped in the hospital chair where the nurse and aide have plunked her like a half-filled bag of laundry no one's hurrying to reach and make clean. She seems to wait for nothing and not to be able to say, she who would talk to the wall I was till she was blue in the face. But what's unsaid makes a life. And this late hour, I'm finally ready to hear tears instead. Despite her effort to stanch them, she who once proclaimed the ice water in those veins, and though the colors drained from her glacier face, what flows away is proof that everything I've heard her say about herself is wrong. All that's known of anyone is tiny, an iceberg perched and dancing on the sea, compared to what sits brooding far below, secret and unfathomable.
Well, there you come with the iceberg. What's going on below this? Yes, what's going on underneath? Yeah, this is another kind of being stunned. But this is a stunning of a more grievous kind, being taken aback by accident and misfortune and so forth.
My mother loved to say that she had ice water in her veins, that she wasn't emotional. And then there, towards the end of her life, I got to learn how much of a lie that was, which I had always suspected. There it was in her tears, which were replacing the words. And I learned.
Yeah. Well, now you're going to read a paired set of poems with the ones you did with Betsy Mars. Yours is A Rent Party, and it's paired with Pyrescence, Betsy's version of involuntary plans and dry hours. Let's read those together and we can tell a little about the pairing of them.
The pairing of them came because a wonderful journal, Alexandria Quarterly, was running a contest and they picked out several very memorable lines from famous poets, from Emily Dickinson, and in this case from Gwendolyn Brooks. And they asked contestants in the contest, those of us who would send $5 along with our poems, to take that line of poetry and cast it in their own poem in a different way. And Betsy and I happened to both try the contest, and you'll see the very different results. But we paired the two poems in our chapbook, which is called In the Muddle of the Night. And mine is called Rent Party, and it's a biblical poem. Oh, by the way, the line from Gwendolyn Brooks is, "We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan." Probably that will jump out at you in my poem because it's so clearly the best line in the poem. This is called Rent Party. Moses came down from the mountain, plenty tired and more than a little singed from the nearness of the flame. And let's face it, wandering through the desert is no picnic, despite the occasional and incidental shrubbery. The hungry folks who drag their feet till now, kvetchy, out of sorts, weary of promises, no milk and honey far as they could see. And when he arrived, he expected a welcome. "Man, what'd you expect while you were gone so long? Who wouldn't have worshipped the golden onion, or at least dance around its root, if only for some dreams of some yet-to-be-fried potatoes?" He was finally spotted out of the corner of one reveler's eye. But no one shouted from joy, "Hey, Moses is back." He muttered to himself something like, "We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan," and knew this was not going to be an easy sell, especially for a guy slow of speech who dropped into this rent party while not totally uninvited, with not much of a plan. Everybody knowing of his checkered past, and let's face it, no track record for bringing home the bacon. And what was this he was carrying in his arms? More unpaid labor nobody was exactly praying for. So that's my version of the great Gwendolyn Brooks line. Betsy took a completely different path with her poem. She wrote a poem called Pyrescence. I think I said that right. And Pyrescence is, I think, of particular hope to those of you who live in the western part of the country who face these terrible fires. And plants are sometimes pyrescent in that the fire releases their seeds. So this is a poem of some hope. And I will tell you, since I'm about to read Betsy's poem, and I hope I do it justice, that Betsy was the winner of this contest. Hers was the prize-winning poem. This is a prize-winning poem by Betsy Mars called Pyrescence. "We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan. Seeds blown in, soon buried in sand. Dry hours without comfort of mead or touch of skin, without clan. We are things. We hunger for lost hours, the involuntary spill of the hourglass and its quicksilver sand. Under the glare of things, in our hubris we planned. Our plans were dry things of involuntary hours, spent laying low on terminal hold, in traffic jams. Our final seconds stretched out like hours. We were parched, This was not part of the plan. We became dry tinder in our last thin hours before our bodies unmanned. We drop like a spark, leave a wildfire burning, crack the shell from the seed, find release, a new plan.
Yes, that. Why do you think that one got so much attention? I notice there's a great repetition of the actual quote in the vocabulary of the poem, and she makes good of the plan with a positive conclusion from what is a sort of disastrous way of bringing about the germination of the seed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a richness there.
I think there is richness in the repetition and the rhyme. And I think in no little part the optimism at the end. Not that she's beating us over the head with the terrible disaster that we're doing to our environment. But there's tremendous subtlety in it too.
Well, I don't think those are, if you didn't confer with one another about how you were going to take that line and did it independently, you do have something coming out of the fire, the sparks, and you make mention of the effect on the face of Moses. So what came there was wisdom of a sort that perhaps has bedeviled humankind.
Yes, well, you know, I think, as is typical of the pairs of Betsy Marr's poems and my poems in our collection, hers tend to be more optimistic, and mine tend slightly toward what she calls the melancholy. So
you want to explain that Alan?
Well, Collins, you know, she thinks there's a tinge of sadness in my poem, a tinge of longing, which there certainly is, which is characteristic of my being. So she's invented this descriptor, melancholy, which I'm happy to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'm not often happy, but I'm happy to wear it.
Yes. Well, it's one of those new humors. You've presented a new humor in the Alan kind of collie. So the anatomy of longing, there you have longing in the very title. So let's hear what you did with that longing of yours.
Yes. And it's from a doctor's visit. And unfortunately, as we get older, we get to spend more and more time with our physicians. The anatomy of longing. When he looks inside, the doctor tells me I'm fine, save for a few loose parts even he can't name. That might be why I feel so hollowed out when he tells me breathe, and then again. And I admit to myself, if not to him, I know this feeling from before, a time I was young and hollowed out for sure. He says, medicine has no name for this, but we can call it longing if you like. He knows I like when things have names, but it takes too long till names come known. What's usually best is just move on, breathe on my own, if not exactly free, then calm and hollowed out the way it was when I used to be.
Yes, that's full of longing. I notice now how the breathiness is a sighing breath of longing. And it comes across that way because of the hollowed out, which goes back to the first poem that you read, I think, about the dry well. You know, there's that cavity that really doesn't take on what it should, the water, the moisture.
Yes, we're always trying to fill up that hollowed out part of ourselves. And in this case, the doctor gave me a name for it, at least ostensibly in the poem. He said, call it longing. Call it longing if you like.
And do you say longing or longing?
Long. I say it like a New Yorker.
Yeah, right. Now, the dark, we're going further into this one with some humor, though. Everybody's had some kind of occasion to have had this worry. And the dark is from your milkman, story of the milkman.
Yes, it appears there, and it is the dark, but it's not particularly scary. The dark. Though I've called the county plenty, the streetlight's been out for days. While I've struggled in this moonless winter dark for the path to the door, crunching in the now faint footsteps I'd previously made, and more than once fumbled my keys and hoped I'd catch them, the way a trapeze artist might feel for the hands of his mate in the neon circus dark. But when they fall, as they will, I pray they'll dent the layer of ice that's limned the lawn for weeks now and might be dug out easy. And God forbid not have to hear them skid down the hill we live atop and back onto the street, which is the direction I've already come so many times. And it's dark down there, and oh, so cold. Don't buy a house on a hill, the inspector had said. You won't be young forever. Dark magic that he could tell the future, and how, like me, that I was bound as if by spell not to pay him any mind.
Yeah, that's so true. How many have dropped their keys in the snow and had to dig down and feel down there, like finding an odd clam down in the sand, you know?
Or it's worse, they travel down the hill back to the street, which is the direction
you've
already come.
Yes, on the icy surface skimming down. Right. Excellent. We're going to hear about one of your uncles, Uncle Harry.
Yes.
Gave you some good advice.
Oh, yes. He was full of advice. My Uncle Harry was a teacher for a long time. And when I decided to become a teacher, he had advice for me. It's called My Uncle Harry. If I insisted on being a teacher, Uncle Harry offered the best advice. Listen, asshole, never turn your back on the class. And he demonstrated how by handing me the leash to his giant killer dog, Mr. Pooch, and then turned himself into a pretzel of a man in half glasses with a crazed asymmetrical look. His arm turned an impossible angle, stabbing the air with phantom chalk on a phantom board. In a day or two, I discovered, even were I to master this contortion, I'd only be an annoyance to the kids I pretended to teach, a fly on Pooch's ass, and maybe, if lucky, I'd get swatted off when he shook his barbed tail and sent anything on it for a spin. mostly my fate was to be ignored, which, looking back, seemed wisdom plenty for eighth graders to possess. Many of them were large for their age, and a few were men and women of the world who made clear they were not to be taken for fools. The Pearl, the Red Pony, and Warner's First Grammar again. One girl, Tanya, looked at me with some pity and said, "Man, you got to be tough with these kids. This is the damn ghetto." It was true. I hadn't been to the Bronx before, though many times I had just driven through.
Yeah. Yes, I bet you've got some experiences from the classroom. Oh. Yeah, I think everyone who's taught has moments that they, if they didn't write about it, they can still imagine those and could still write about it because of what happened that day. And here, I think this contortion is a very funny, it's a very funny image that you've created again. So your Alan Colley comes with a good bit of real humor. The witty kind of humor. And your Uncle Harry was a great contortionist.
Yes, he was a tough man, which I never managed to be as a teacher. As Sonia's telling me in the poem from the very beginning, you're too soft, man, to teach here in the ghetto. But as I learned, it took me many years. There are other ways to get it done.
Why did you even try to get through the Red Pony?
Well, you know, David, in English department book rooms, there were books there from the 1920s, 1930s. You know, there was The Bridge of San Luis Rey, and there was everything by Steinbeck, who's a wonderful writer, as is Thornton Wilder. But kids in 1970s and 80s and on needed things that they would actually want to read.
Yeah. Well, I think Red Badge of Courage would have done quite well in advance of some of the wars we've had instead of the Red Pony.
Well, the Red Pony was difficult to teach, especially when I discovered that I was the only one in the room who had actually read it.
In the early days, if only they had allowed books that had, well, you know, like Howl in the poetry section, mm-hmm. or, you know, really appropriate things, Soul on Ice.
Sure.
You know, things like that. That would have hit home. She's going to go through some things. Donald Trump, about Marie Yovanovitch.
She was our ambassador to Ukraine, and she is a brilliant woman, and was doing wonderful work and representing us in Ukraine, but Donald Trump had other plans for her, and before she was fired, he assured the president of Ukraine that she, Marie Yovanovitch, she's going to go through some things, ominous words. And as I'll sometimes do with my current events poems, I'll try to explore the idea more than the particular moment. So I wrote this poem, and when it was published, my friend Betsy Mars again decided she was taken with a line in it. My line is "cold floors of unkindness," and she invited other poets to take that line and to write their own poems based on that line, and she created an anthology. She runs a press called Kingly Street Press, and the book is called Floored, F-L-O-O-R-E-D. And my poem is the lead-off poem in the book. She's going to go through some things. From the day she was born, we knew this would happen. and kind of figured that would happen too. It even made us smile in anticipation, as if life might truly be an adventure, though it's not always what we believe. It's what we want to teach her. Sure, there'd be the teething, the testing, the travail of long division, apartments without heat, cold floors of unkindness, plenty of tears, friends moving away, breakups, dishonesty in those we'd trusted, maybe even losing a job unjustly. So much might happen that demands recourse where there finally is none. What's sort of true, life's as sad as we make it, and as happy too. Humans will do evil things from indifference or intent, and still we move on. It's in the moving and doing what we know is right that might finally be enough.
Yes, you've got take on some optimism about your work. You do you do wonderful poetry, and
thanks,
so I'm very happy
David.
To have done another session with Alan Wallowitz of Long Island. This has been Sound Poetry, and I was your host with Alan on Sound Poetry. My name, David Gilmore. Remember the poet Alan Wallowitz. He'll floor you. Thank you.
Thank you, David.